Welcome to the Fusion Forest. This is a production of Asheville FM Podcasts. Asheville FM is Asheville's community radio station, and to learn more, see other Asheville FM podcasts and our on-air broadcast schedule, go to ashevillefm.org. I'm your host, Leaf, and in this episode, I'm joined by Craig Trester, who is a molecular biologist, community science advocate, science educator, applied mycologist, and many other things. A science renaissance man, you could say. Craig was involved with some of the original open source community laboratories in this country. It started up in New York City and has been teaching people of a range of ages for years now on topics ranging from DNA barcoding to soil microscopy to mushroom cultivation, microbiology, and more. Craig was a wealth of information, and we talked about soil, the development of ecosystems, the connection between plant health, fungal health, soil health, and more. We get into the importance of DNA for mushroom identification and a whole range of topics. At certain points, we fall into a deep dive of these topics that involves lots of scientific jargon, so keep that in mind and bear with it. There might be terms that go beyond the listener's vocabulary, but the overall message is still important. And this discussion is important for laying the template of a deeper understanding of what the ground that we walk on is actually made out of and how it relates to being able to grow good food and many other functions of a healthy landscape. So sit back and enjoy my discussion with Craig Trester here in the Fusion Forest. Hi, Craig. Thanks for joining me here in the Fusion Forest.
What's going on, Leaf? Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, not too much. I am just curious to hear about some of your work and what you've been up to. This is a nature science talk program. And if I'm not mistaken, you are an environmental educator of sorts, right?
Definitely. It's been interesting how I got into it, and we'll kind of cover that story. So I'm an environmental educator and a citizen scientist, kind of at the intersection of mycology, soil, microbiology, but more towards the application of such. So I started MYC.NYC back in 2018 as an applied mycological educational resource, kind of teaching the benefits that fungi provide to our health, our environment, and our society as a larger whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so before we go any further, in case some of our listeners are already lost, could you define and delineate and maybe explain the relations between mycology, microbiology, and soil health?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it in perspective. Mycology is the study of fungi. Fungi are interesting because most people's experience with fungi, you know, when we say fungi, mushrooms or molds or, you know, mycelium or, you know, these organisms, most people don't really have much of interaction with it. It's either kind of in a culinary sense, or, you know, they have an unpleasant experience that's growing on something they're trying to like preserve in their refrigerator, but exhibiting the fact that these organisms are the cyclers of nutrients in nature. And kind of connecting it with the microbiology, it's interesting because, you know, the filamentous fungi that we see, these macrofungi as mushrooms, they kind of go through these stages where their individual filaments of the mycelium, the hyphae, they're microscopic. They're, you know, 4 to 20 microns in diameter. So they have these microscopic stages of the life cycle where they aggregate, they become macroscopic, and then obviously producing a fruiting body, a mushroom. You know, and then the vast majority of fungi, though, are microscopic molds or yeasts, or the some of them filamentous or budding, but don't produce these large macro reproductive fruiting body structures. And kind of tying it into soil, fungi are very much the architects of the soil. They are one, most people are common with them. If you go out foraging for mushrooms in the woods, they are decomposing organic matter. They're sapotropic. So usually breaking down the complex structures of cellulose, lignin, hemicellulose, the structural polymers that make up plant matter. They're also mutualists. They're also the symbionts. Rather than just decomposing our matter, they're forming these very intricate symbiotic relationships with plants on the exterior parts of plants, but also the interior parts, and actually cycling and moving these nutrients back and forth. And amazingly, through their vast aggregates of hyphal networks in the soil, working with plants to increase the surface area of roots and access to nutrients tens of thousands folds. And even further, these hyphal filaments and the massive amount of surface area they occupy. I think an estimate is that in a healthy agricultural soil, an acre of healthy agricultural soil, there's about 2 tons of mycelium. And that in a number of older growth forests, a lot of these mycorrhizal fungi, they'll account for roughly 70% of the actual biomass of the soil. They're the kind of architects in the soil that their biomass is a surface, a substrate by which all these different microecologies exist on. Bacteria, other fungi, nematodes, microarthropods. And it's amazing because we tend to think about ecology as kind of these plants and animals, these macroscopic organisms. But what's even more interesting is that the microbial ecology of the soil, kind of the soil food web, which we'll kind of get into later, and I've alluded a bit to about, is just as important, if not more, because it's the foundational level of nutrient cycling, building all the structure as where all these keystone species set the stage for the types of life forms we're more common with every single day. So I guess in a nutshell, that's kind of the interrelation between mycology, soil, and kind of microbiology. So
yeah, wow, must be a pretty big nut to fit all that inside of its shell. Clearly this is a very deep and interesting subject. And what kind of age groups of people or audiences do you teach this kind of information to?
So yeah, it's really interesting. It's a great question, because I started out teaching, even before I got into it, of kind of being a teacher, both of a tutor in subjects, also teaching English and also tutoring Chinese to both Chinese immigrants, teaching them English as part of my volunteering, and also tutoring Chinese. So working with students an age range from middle schoolers to high school, college to adults. So I kind of had that base background in working with things that are a bit complex. English is actually a pretty complex language. We tend to forget that as native speakers. But yeah, so I had that background. But speaking on more recently what I do now with NYC, all age groups and ages, from middle school to high school to college to adults, because it's really interesting, because we really, fungi are kind of this, it's really this really gap in a knowledge base. And we think about the fact that fungi were formally separated from plants back in the late 60s, 1969, and that it's less than 100 years old, and they play such a huge role in our ecology. So really, students of all ages, because one, for the younger generation, it's important they have that supplemented in their education. And this is kind of the opportunities I've had working with a number of educational, not-for-profits, ecological conservation organizations to kind of provide this education they recognize is fundamental, but really hasn't gotten to the point of getting moved through kind of a formal curriculum and education, and also how do you go about the process of pedagogy to teach these things. Then with college students, because there's a huge thing now with the interest of kind of fungi are really in vogue, between gourmet or medicinal fungi that have immunomodulatory properties. Both gourmet and medicinal do have these properties. Biomaterials, so the fact is these fungal mycelium can be made into replacements for animal or synthetic based polymers that are used to make clothing. An even further aspect, kind of what I got into, was the remediation, the fact that fungi are these incredible cyclers of nutrients, decomposers, recomposers, and mutualists, and that, you know, as kind of we're approaching the Anthropocene, well, we're in the Anthropocene, a lot of the anthropogenic materials that we have, they're made up of a lot of the similar stuff that's been here for a long times for, and these fungi have been here through quite a long period of time on not only Earth's different ecological histories, but geological histories as well. So
yeah, before we go forward, could you just briefly define what the Anthropocene is and relate it to other epochs?
Yeah, definitely. So usually talking about in geology or earth science, we kind of talk about at what stages the earth went through based upon its geological morphology. Is we have these tectonic plates that are make up our world, whether they're exposed above water or below water, they're still very active and floating on this mantle and moving around. And so as a result, this is affected on different rock formations, and we can look at the geological strata and look through time to see what kind of life forms have lived through these aspects. So normally, anyone who's familiar with the concept of archaeology or paleontology, we understand that you dig down, you find remnants of either past ecologies in time or past civilizations within time as well, more recent time, with we're talking about humans. So the Anthropocene is the fact is we're starting to produce things that don't so readily recompose and produce them on a quantity that they're becoming apparent parts of the fossil record. So the anthropogenic capacity. So this is more so with our production of petroleum hydrocarbons, with plastics, artificial materials that are durable, and kind of changing the way that we dynamically interact with them, that maybe our ancestors who were living a lifestyle which was much more based upon natural materials and fibers and constructions versus artificial, or as we've learned to apply more science, don't quite readily decompose, are pretty much more static. It's the whole thing that like that plastic styrofoam coffee cup will probably hang around longer in the soil than the entirety of recorded human history in the past couple hundred years, you know, well beyond that as well.
And so anthro is referring to humans. And so the Anthropocene is like the era in the geological record where humans are the, we'd say, driving influence on what makes it different than past parts of the Earth's history.
Yep.
Awesome. And so you work through an organization called NYCMYC, that's correct?
Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of started, it was like Mycology in New York City, and it was interesting. It started out as just an Instagram page because I was really interested in learning about micromediation and applying it, and I was joined a community biology lab back in end of 2017, 2018, and I started doing this work, and people were interested in opening up to the community there, and I was like, okay, I need to document it, right? So it started out as a way just to kind of be like a visual kind of notebook or a journal, and then it kind of evolved with different opportunities to teaching. So yeah, it's more so, quote unquote, like a DBA or doing business as just myself. And it's something definitely with a number of people that are kind of in the similar community that I've met, they will have themselves, but a kind of moniker or a title that they'll use, which kind of becomes a brand because it's part of like, oh, you had a social media handle, like a name versus yourself, and kind of a slant to it. So yeah, it's the mycological educational resource that I started to kind of teach benefits about fungi, and it rolls off the tongue a little better, and rather than just me as myself as an educator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's settling into the digital marketing landscape, sounds like. Yeah, so I actually am curious to learn a little bit more about, you mentioned working in a community biology lab up in New York City there, and there might be around, as far as I know, I'm not aware of any community biology labs here in Asheville. I don't know if those are things that more exist in larger cities, but could you just talk a little bit about your experience at the community lab and, you know, kind of maybe the range of different things people were working on, and is there collaboration between the people using the space?
Definitely. So it's really quite interesting because if you go back about just over 10 years ago, there were no really such things as community biology labs. And so the place where I got my start, GenSpace, was actually the first community biology lab. It was initially started by a really good mentor of mine, Dr. Ellen Jorgensen. So she was doing a number of initiatives, a career in research science as well, molecular biology. I believe her thesis was on molecular virology. So it was kind of the aspect that there was this whole DIY bio kind of online group that started, and it started with her typing in, hey, anyone kind of want to start a community lab or get together to try this stuff? And she was kind of impressed that a lot of people were fascinated by what you could do with molecular biology, working with DNA, extracting and amplifying it using PCR, and being able to analyze it and learn a lot about the rich amount of genetic information is in every single cell of a living organism. Mm. So that kind of got started in 2000, and I think 2008, 9 is when it kind of got first kicked off. So it's been 10 years now. And now there are community biology labs all over the world, big cities and smaller cities all over yeah, it's pretty amazing. It definitely is kind of a thing where kind of in bigger metropolitan areas, it tends to be one that props up because you'll have a group of people. There are informal ones that I know of, like people just get together, like kind of like through a meetup group or have a space where they meet. And this kind of happened largely due to my understanding of the 2008 financial crisis. A number of biotech companies kind of went belly up. And so all this equipment went on the market to be auctioned off. A number of people who are interested in kind of doing this individual work, you know, got together, acquired this equipment, and even people who had experience kind of outfitted these labs. So it was really kind of amazing how, you know, I got into this point around 2016, 2017, and was looking for a place to just do my lab work. You know, a big thing, kind of thing I got into, it was learning about micromediation, kind of applied mycology, joined the New York Mycological Society, was reading about some of the micromediation work. Went to a workshop run by two ecological program managers up at Van Cortlandt Park, New York City. It's a pretty large park up in New York City, over 1,000 acres. It's got some pretty natural ecologies up there as well, least disturbed. And these two ecological program managers were teaching a workshop on mushroom cultivation and micromediation. And I went and I heard about the applied mycology, learned about radical mycology, learned about these aspects and how there was kind of this community that was there and people trying to utilize it in a kind of direct action kind of way. And it was pretty mind blowing. So I started doing this stuff and, you know, bought a pressure cooker, bought like Petri dishes, was pouring agar in my apartment. And I had, you know, was growing.
Home lab.
Yeah. Home lab. Like, you know, and you know, it's up to a certain point, your roommates will throw out your Petri dishes and like ask, why are you growing mold in the fridge? I'm like, well, I'm not, but it is. But, you know, trying to explain the difference between like a filamentous fungi that's like a macro fungi versus something like a penicillium or like it's good growing.
You've said too much already. Their eyes have glazed over and they're not having any.
Yeah,
they
just no anymore. So yeah, I at that point I was like, all right, you know, probably need to find a space to do it. So I was like looking. I was actually kind of like studio space to do it, but then I heard about the community biology lab and it was perfect because like, you know, for a set amount of money a month you could have space, you can do a project as long as it worked within it. And one of the prerequisites of it was to take some courses on molecular biology they offered. So it was really amazing because at the same time, the club that I was a part of, the New York Mycological Society, they were getting into DNA barcoding fungi. They
have this... to just talk a little bit about what DNA barcoding is?
Yeah. So DNA barcoding is the process by which you can identify organisms not by sequencing their whole genome, but by sequencing a select region. It's a region that contains a portion of a couple of genes and then some areas that are spacers. So, you know, genes are important. Like they to have their sequence conserved is important because otherwise the gene won't be able to be translated into a protein and function. So that could be a big problem. Anyway, so this barcode region is an area that has a nice mix of variable and non-variable DNA that's identified by different organisms. So then you could, rather than sequencing the whole genome, you could use a technique called PCR, polymerase chain reaction, to amplify, make lots of copies of this region you've isolated from a cell. Then you could send that in to be sequenced, and you would get the sequence of A, T, Gs, and Cs, the nucleotides. You could then, once that's been digitized, you have the sequence, you could then feed it into a bioinformatics algorithm. And then it's like kind of Googling like a DNA code. And then you can cross-reference that and get a pretty close match to that as well. So, yeah, it's pretty neat. It's like Googling an organism's genetic code.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I've had a couple people on the show who've mentioned DNA barcoding. Or a few months ago, I was talking to an animal biologist who did a lot of environmental DNA type of research.
Ooh, eDNA.
Doing that. And she was doing that with like water samples. She'd done it with some fresh water with trying to find turtle DNA. And then it also done it in marine water, trying to find like seal DNA and abalone DNA. Is there an overlap between eDNA and barcoding, or are they completely different things?
So the simplest thing, like just barcoding, is you're looking for these barcoding regions. So you're looking for these areas of the genome that you know you can look for variants or conservation between different types of organisms. So, for example, in the environment, there's a mix of DNA everywhere, right? DNA is everywhere. It's pretty persistent. However, what you can do is you can isolate from an environmental sample of water, soil, and filter it out, and then aliquot certain amounts of this extracted solution with the DNA and then add in certain primers which will specifically bind to parts of that region based upon certain organisms. So if you're scooping up a bit of a sample from water and you're looking at fish or you're looking at zooplankton or other kind of aquatic organisms, there's all these different primers that select for these different barcode regions based upon the organism. So the eDNA, you can work within this preparation in a couple different techniques that I won't get into, but it's a more advanced version of, whereas barcoding fungi is pretty simple. You just take a little bit of the tissue, grind it up, and it's, you know what you're working with and you can design it. But if you're doing eDNA, you're working with a set of primers and arranged based upon what you want to work with. And then based upon if you're using a older DNA sequencing technique called Sanger sequencing, or if you're using something like Next Generation, there are a number of different workflows and preparations to get that library of DNA ready to be feed into a DNA sequencer to then help you know what you're looking for.
Okay, interesting. So on the note of these DNA barcoding and eDNA techniques you just said, let's bring it back to the teaching you do, both in the school setting and also in the informal setting that I imagine you have more curious and adult learners. When you teach these types of classes, are you teaching things like how to do DNA barcoding or other techniques for microbiology or studying the soil?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because I do a number of aspects kind of transitioning from the DNA. We'll talk about that. So I've taught a number of workshops, both in a lab space, community lab, where you have a controlled environment, where we would go out on a mushroom walk to, like, let's say, like a park, or, you know, Greenwood Cemetery is nearby, Gen Space, where I was initially doing it, or even Prospect Park, which is close by Biotech Without Borders, which is another organization. Go out, you'd find the mushrooms, you'd kind of do the field ID, bring them back, you'd extract the tissue, you'd isolate the DNA, amplify it, verify it using a process called gel electrophoresis, which allows you to look at the DNA through a fluorescent dye, and that's suspended in a gel, and then send it in for sequencing. So yeah, I've actually taught the hands-on stuff to groups and through spaces, but also taken it on the road. I've actually taught some DNA barcoding workshops across the country, a number of mycology summits and festivals, and even some mushroom farms. So through all this kind of portable lab equipment, so kind of like a lab in a bag. That's one aspect, because in the perspective I'll talk about that is, like, people are like, why do I need to learn this? I'm like, well, it's another way to learn about our natural world, but also, you know, the one thing people kind of forget that it's not just about a qualitative, it's also about quantitative, counting and measuring and having something to write down, and how that could be a huge impact in generating data about our ecology that could actually save it if there was some aspect that might be damaged or sort of need to provide some evidence.
So on the quantitative side, does that mean you can do these genetic techniques to tell how much of something is there and not just that it's there in the first place?
Well, a little bit of both. It depends upon the design of the experiment and reproducing as well. So there are some interesting aspects about, you can do some more quantitative techniques, a little more technical we'll get into, but yeah, so based upon how you design your experiment and what techniques, but okay, you could do some interesting applications.
And another question on that, because you're talking about people going out on mushroom forays or going to farms and identifying the mushrooms using the DNA barcoding techniques. What do you really need to do that? Can't you just pick the mushrooms and look at them and identify them that way?
So this is the amazing thing, is that, like, fungi are pretty cryptic and elusive. And it's really interesting, because when the molecular techniques, molecular biology got integrated into mycology, a lot of people felt some kind of way, because you could truly separate basically species that were formerly thought to be related based upon morphology, but are quite different. Because the one thing about fungi is realizing that they're quite prolific in their ability to converge on evolutionarily in shape and form and structure.
Mm-hmm. And so by converge, you mean like multiple different species or lineages ending up having like the same trait, or like unrelated fungi having mushrooms that look the same.
Well, similar shapes and forms, and even too within a species, like what dispensates it branching off to become a new species, right? Beyond becoming a variety. So the molecular analysis really lets you look at how much change has occurred in the genes, in its genome, in critical areas that normally don't vary that much. One example I like to talk about is pretty amazing, is understanding the ectomycorrhizal fungi. the mycorrhizal fungi that grow on the outside of the plant root, there's so many species of them that all converge. They were all saprotrophic fungi, but, you know, can basically converged on forming these mutual symbiotic relationships with plants, but still conserving part of their saprotrophic genes to allow certain types of decomposition as well. So it's pretty amazing because there's a lot of information you can learn about. For example, if you're trying to find a new type of mushroom or finding a mushroom in an area that normally doesn't, especially with climate change and certain and our shifts in global warming, how our ecologies are shifting in based upon their normal climate type, that could be a way to really kind of prospect and actually have a documentation that isn't just hearsay.
All right, that's interesting. So you can use it as a technique to kind of track how species are changing over time, even within our own lifetimes. Let's transition out of the genetic world, and I want to ask you, are there techniques that you teach or are aware of that don't require using genetics and primers and all that, that allow people to assess what's alive in their soil and what's not?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, microscopy, that's probably the best way to do it. Something I've really been diving into the past.
The use of microscopes.
Yeah.
Is what that is, right?
I'll be a little better at just clarifying if I use it, maybe a bit of an obtuse, up an apro term. Yeah. So microscopy, the use of using a microscope, because, the big thing of why, genetic work really got picked up and interested is because you can spend a lot of time like delving into the microcosmos, looking at slides and all these different fields of understanding what's in your soil or growing on something, or heck, even looking at the structures of these fine, fascinating organisms that you really can't see with your own naked eyes. So getting into the soil, and that's something I've been getting into, how do you assess the microbiology in your soil? And you really have to do with a microscope if you're not going to use molecular techniques, because it's the understanding that you can look at your soil and understand, okay, like, what is the ecology like? Is it diverse? You know, is it diverse bacterially? Is it diverse fungally? What stage of succession is it happening? And succession refers to the process by which there's been some kind of ecological disturbance. And over time, it's gradually kind of moving its way towards an advanced ecosystem, like an old growth forest where it's fungally dominant, but the fungi being the architects of the soil are creating all the structure and all this surface area for other plants to basically associate with and trade nutrients, but also for microbiology to live on and around.
But we talked about fungi a bit in their architecture, and bacteria, I imagine people are pretty familiar with, but could you briefly describe the importance of bacteria or some of these other types of organisms that live in the soil and why they're important to plant health?
Totally, absolutely. So it's interesting too, because when I first got into studying fungi, I was like, oh, it's all about fungi, right? And it's funny, like, as much as we want to think system sometimes, it's very easy to fall back into that reduced thinking trap and realize it's part of a bigger picture. But yeah, in the soil, bacteria are also pivotal. They're everywhere. They're far more able to break down a lot of these simpler types of sugars and foods and proteins, whereas fungi are far more able to break down the more complex ones. You know, even a number of the waste products that fungi produce, these large molecular weight compounds, these ulmic, these humic and fulvic acids, only fungi can break them down and can actually sit in the soil unutilized by bacteria, if that's only a population. And then we understand in general, it's a whole ecology, whereas these bacteria and fungi, they're able to decompose organic matter, but also too, they can solubilize out of the sand, silt, and clay, the parent material, the whole range of micronutrients, macronutrients, and trace elements for minerals that you know plants need to survive. So this whole mutualism of exchange between, you know, plants being able to basically farm microbes and attract them from producing exudates.
And so are you saying that the plants cannot actually access these nutrients from the soil directly through their roots, but they need these microorganisms to do it for them?
Well, yeah, that's kind of the big part of how it works. You know, it's interesting. How did people grow food before they were industrial fertilizers? That's the thing I do think about. Like, you know, like, and like, and the reality is that, you know, it's understanding that like decomposition, the cycling of nutrients was essential, and that I think a lot about how the reason why the westward of expansion that happened in America, actually, and even let alone like the movement of European peoples to the New World once they quote unquote discovered it, or, you know, accidentally bumped into it thinking it was an entirely different continent was because the prospect of these fertile soils, because they hadn't been disturbed through the conventional method of tilling. So breaking up all of the aggregates that these fungi and bacteria were building oxidized the soils and broke it up, and to the point where you had to apply manure. You had to apply this animal-based fertilizer, and why, you know, the concept of composting, kind of going back to a number of people that picked it up more so, I believe, in the 19th century, I observing how people in the Indian subcontinent were doing it, this was a way to basically facilitate the cycling of nutrients by arranging compositions of different organic materials to decompose in an accelerated fashion.
Yeah, that's cool. And so you mentioned compost, which I think has become a relatively common practice in the modern America. Not that everyone does it, but lots of people have compost piles and little compost barrels or compost worms. And that's a method, you're saying, for creating a lot of this biological diversity that then you can add back into the soil. Mm-hmm. I've also heard that nowadays there's these, I don't know if they're initially new, but these techniques that people have been starting to practice more that kind of take the essence of composting but make it a little more efficient and not requiring hauling around giant mounds of manure and other things. I think it's called natural farming. Is that something that you are know about or would like to talk about?
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's funny. Well, perspective, I got into fungi because I was interested in environmental remediation of the soil and learn about fungi, and then that led me into learning about the soil and then learning about natural farm practices, which are a way to like inoculate a compost, your compost, with the beneficial microbes that are already doing it in these advanced succession ecosystems where there's less disturbance going on. So yeah, natural farming, which is pretty amazing, interesting. It's in the United States, it's called Korean natural farming, which is funny because it just happened to be, you know, really kind of taught by Master Cho or Cho Cho San-yu, which master just means teacher in like kind of a transliteration. Natural farming is how you can understand that in ecologies where succession has gone through, you have a diversity of microorganisms, bacteria, fungi, nematodes, microarthropods, yeasts, and even actual viruses that actually attack bacteria and fungi and are hugely responsible for the majority of biomass, and but all part of this basically this life feeding on life process. You know, on microbial scale, things happen much faster. So how do you culture those or capture that kind of snapshot of like a forest soil and take it to your compost pile or take it to your land where you want diversity, but maybe you don't want to wait a long time or have to haul everything or, you know, evaluate. So it's the natural farming practices are an amazing way that something I'm learning more and more about and how to understand, and something eventually I'd like to apply the molecular techniques to really kind of quantitatively and qualitatively assess what's happening. Mm. Yeah, that's kind of the fascinating part of it.
Yeah, so in the compost or the inoculum you create through natural farming, you're creating a very diverse community of microorganisms, but you can't really know what exactly is living in there unless you do something like some of that genetic analysis or environmental DNA, right? And just, I haven't really heard of people doing full genetic sequencing on their compost to know what's in there. So it sounds like it's maybe a field that's ripe for exploration.
Definitely. And well, it's interesting too, because compost, well, like when people are first learning about it, you'd maybe go to your municipal DPW or whatever, where they would like take trees that were down and chip them, or like food scraps, and they do it. And sometimes people will pick it up and they'd be like, oh, I got this compost and I put it on my plants and all my plants died. And then someone who knew a little bit more about compost would be like, oh no, this is just like putrefied organic matter, or this is just like mulch. So it's the composition, which is interesting. And so, yeah, it's interesting. Like, we're learning how to apply it. But one of the best ways to make it kind of not foolproof, but really, really allow for a big fudge factor is having an inoculum of these microorganisms that you could propagate. That the biggest thing is, like, all these things are amazing and you can assess through qualitative, oh, wow, my plants grew or this and that, the soil. But, you know, like, this is where research needs to be done. This is where a lot of the techniques that kind of get knocked about being a stickler or to scrutinizing. We need robust methods to document and to measure and evaluate, because if there's truly some amazing things that are being done using these natural farming techniques, that's something that is an exciting part of science to move into, because you could truly understand what is happening in these unique processes and techniques by understanding, like, you know, the ranges of microbes. And even tuing, when you're dealing with soil microbes, some of them haven't even been classified. We can only culture less than 2% of microbes.
By culture, you mean culture, you mean that we can, like, grow them in a controlled setting?
Yes. So growing them usually on agar.
That's a seaweed-based gelatin powder.
Yeah, it's a powder that comes from red seaweed. Also, you can get it from Asian grocery stores. It's oftentimes used as like a gelatin substitute. I think actually when Robert Koch, he was one of the quote unquote founders of modern medicine bacteriology. It was actually his lab assistant Petrie kind of came from that. And basically realized you can use agar, but it was actually Petrie's wife that discovered that agar was this powder from a seaweed that made basically this heterogeneous gelatin structure was way better for culturing microbes.
I think I've heard this story before, that it was like he was doing his microbiology lab work and his wife like figured this out from cooking and then told him about it. And then he got a bunch of accolades and never really said where he got the idea from. And it didn't come out till later that his wife actually invented it.
Yeah, there's a lot of those stories in history. You know, Marie Curie, when basically it was a wife husband duo, and initially, I think the foundation that gives it the Nobel Prize only initially wanted to recognize her husband, Rosalind Franklin, with the structure of DNA, doing X-ray crystallography on DNA, and kind of she passed away, and so Watson and Crick got it. It's pretty amazing. But yeah, to that point, we understood a lot about microbiology and pathology from that, but realized that like we kind of shifted microbes as being these bad things, these pathogens, that when in reality we're covered in microbes, they're actually essential for our health. And we're realizing the microbiome is a foundational part of our health. And the more a diverse microbiome, the healthier you are. It changes your mood, your behavior, what you'll eat. And we're just starting to begin to understand this as well.
That's a whole another topic of discussion.
So getting
save that for later.
Getting back to the soil, though, we can only culture on agar in this defined media 2% of the organisms that are out there, because, you know, think about how many different combinations of organic matter that are in the soil. It's mind blowing. So oftentimes when you do a number of these sequencing of the soil, but also the gut of the microbiome, you get these unknown hits because we haven't been able to like actually understand them. That's when you can kind of really go down the rabbit hole, because you can make these things called OTUs, organizational taxonomic units, when you can group these organisms by how similarly or dissimilarly related are their genomes, but also certain genes to identify them. And then the ones that don't reference back, you can actually see the ones that you don't have any reference that are quote unquote unknown, you can kind of group them based upon that and start understanding functions based upon the genes and really understand what these genes are doing and how similar or dissimilar. You know, the soil is a black box, and it's kind of amazing. We know more about the stars and the cosmos above us than we do about the soil beneath our feet. It's truly a microcosmos.
Wow, yeah. So it sounds, there's so much going on there. It sounds so profound, and we have so much to learn still. So at this point, I kind of understand a little bit maybe why they didn't teach me too much about this in high school biology. It sounds a little complex, and you know, sometimes maybe in science classes, they don't want to admit how little we know about what's going on in nature. But it sounds like people like you and a lot of great researchers out there are trying to delve into this, communicate about it, let people know about it. So yeah, thanks so much for taking time to come join me here in the Fusion Forest and talk about your work and go down some rabbit holes of soil biology and techniques. And come back sometime soon and we can go a little deeper into these various topics.
Indeed. Thank you for having me.
And before you leave, if people want to follow your work, keep up with what you're doing, or support what you're doing, how would they do that?
All right. So the easiest way to follow me is my Instagram. This is a bit of a fun little mirror example. My Instagram is nyc.myc. But if you go to the URL, if you type into your browser, myc.myc, it'll directly forward to my Instagram, and you can contact me via email, Craig, C-R-A-I-G, at myc.nyc.
All right. So to clarify, MYC, like mycological, and NYC, like New York City.
Yep. For the domain. Yeah. And I'll give you my email address to put in the show notes.
Great. Great. Yeah. That'll be awesome. Well, thanks so much. You have a wonderful evening, and hopefully you'll be back in the Fusion Forest again sometime soon.
Likewise. Great to be here.
Thanks again to Craig for joining me for that discussion. And if you want to follow him, you can check him out on Instagram at nyc.myc, as in New York City dot mycology. You can also contact him through email at craig@myc.nyc. The Fusion Forest is a production of Asheville FM Podcasts, so go to ashevillefm.org to learn about our community radio station, see all the programming we offer, and maybe even think about contributing and giving a donation or becoming a volunteer for Asheville FM. Thanks for listening.